Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is part two of my two-part interview with Maureen Ryan. She was the TV critic for the Huffington Post, the Chicago Tribune, Variety, and currently she is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. If you joined us last week, you know that she wrote a terrific book called Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and a Call for Change in Hollywood. If you missed part one after you listened to this, go back and check that out. She talks a lot about the harassment, the bias that is prevalent in the TV industry. This week, we get into some well-run shows. We also talk a little bit about what we can do to improve the industry. We touch upon bad actors' behavior, and we also talk a little bit about unions and the Writers Guild strike. So that's this week, part two with Maureen Ryan, coming up right now on Hollywood and Levine. You also spend a lot of time in the book talking about shows that are run well.
Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, I'll never forget the day, you know, I was working on this story. I'll tell you, this is exclusive for your podcast. The story I was working on at the time was about Bull. And then I later published a piece in the Hollywood Reporter that said that Glenn Gordon Caron and an actor from Bull, and Glenn was at that time the showrunner of Bull, they both departed the series, which is what you're allowed to say in the trades. And I will let people in both of them. There had been HR investigations in connection with both men. What you want to read into that is entirely up to you. So I was working on that story, and that was, again, like a heartbreak for me, because like Moonlighting is a foundational show for all, like, in my view, like it was incredible.
And Glenn created that show and was the showrunner. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and the thing is, you can read all the coverage of that show back in the day. There was so much chaos and so much, you know, insanity went on. But so I'm working on this show and I'm hearing from people working at Bull, and it, you know, I actually reached out because the people at Bull, understandably, were very nervous because they did not know what the future of their show or the future of their boss was going to be. So I reached out to people who had worked on previous Glenn Gordon Caron shows, and some people who worked for him on Medium were willing to talk to me. And, you know, essentially they said, everyone I've ever talked to who worked for Glenn has said the following: I learned some things about writing from him, but let me say this. Allegedly, they had a lot of experiences that left their self-esteem basically not in good shape from those work experiences. So Melinda, I kind of got to know her through that story. And she's like, oh, this might be, I don't know if this is just irrelevant to you, but here's, you know, she had ascended to the rank of showrunner. She and with other creative collaborators ran a bunch of shows on the CW, and she's still doing stuff in TV. She sent me a note that she sent to potential new hires for her writing staff. And it was so, I got to tell you, Ken, like, I remember reading that and just like starting to cry, because I was like, I've always known there are good showrunners and good-hearted people who, even if they mess up, are accountable, look after their staffs, try to be good people. That's always been something that's happened. But she just talked about, here are the hours we'll keep. Here we'll be transparent about deadlines. Here's how we'll collaborate as a team. These are the expectations for meetings and this and that. And it was just so considerate that the person thinking of joining the staff was not just a potential writing hire, but, you know, a human being with a life. And we want you to do a good job and to work hard, but here's how we're going to do things on our end to make your life, to make it possible for you to do your best work. And, you know, from everything I've heard from people who work for Melinda Shue Taylor, that's the kind of environment that she and her collaborators created. And so part of what made me emotional about that was, like, I felt like that Glenn story and just like so many stories I was doing at that time were so repetitive about, like, this is not, and I began to question, like, my own sanity at certain points. Like, am I crazy? This doesn't seem that hard to be a decent human being who is not running roughshod over other people. So that was actually a turning point for me. And as I was pitching the book around, I said, look, I know a number of people in the industry who, as you know, I don't know of a single person in the industry who has not worked with someone who was abusive. I just don't. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm just running in the wrong mm-hmm. crowd. Like, abusive or in some way damaging, in no way interested in changing their behavior or evolving for the better. We all know what we're talking about here. So I just said to everybody as I was pitching the book around, and that was in the proposal that we sent out, if this is only a series of takedowns and this show was bad or that production was very problematic, I don't even want to do it. We have to show people there are a number of people on a number of fronts who have been trying to create better models of leadership and collegiality, and they've been successful. Like, you know, the go-to that I always go to is I first met Vince Gilligan 30 years ago on the Fox lot. He had this tiny little cramped office with, like, I remember there was a prop sign from one of his episodes stuffed in the corner. And he was like this tall Virginia guy, like just stuffed into this tiny office. And this was before Fox had really exploded. I mean, The Simpsons was doing well, but like, The Simpsons, Idol, The X-Files, those
kinds. He was on The X-Files at the time.
He was on The X-Files.
Right. And for those who don't know, Vince Gilligan is the gentleman who created Breaking Bad.
Right, and co-created Better Call Saul with Peter Gould. And for 30 years, I've known people who've known Vince Gilligan. And for 30 years, they've all had the ability to just say, no, but I've never heard anything but that he runs a really collegial, professional place where people can do, like, they do work hard. They really do. Everyone is held to a high standard, but it's...
He gives everybody credit, too.
He gives people credit. Sean Ryan is that way. Melinda Shue Taylor, you know, Javi Grigio, Mark Swatch. There are so many people I've talked to in the industry who the minute you say, hey, I like your show, or I like this episode, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, the person who wrote that episode, or, oh, you know what, the director had this great idea. And, you know, you're like that. You're always telling me about, like, oh, well, you know, this is what this actor brought to that moment. And we have had many a wine-soaked dinner where you're telling me the good and the bad of different collaborations. Mm. And so it was always on my mind that, you know, in the media, we know what gets clicks. And what gets clicks is, oh, one nightmare person creates drama or creates problems and whatever. And I've written my share of those stories, but I'm like, I would be doing a disservice to the industry and leaving everybody just super depressed and not willing to tell their friends, hey, go buy this book. If I just did that, like, we know that the toxicity and the enabling happens, but what we need to know more about is that these big giant corporations that mostly control the industry, they could do a lot more to help people have the resources and training and support they need to run healthy environments. They just do. I don't think they do enough. And I go into that in the book. they could and should spend more of their billions not on executive pay, but on actually paying their rank and file workers what they're worth, you know, paying for training and oversight and resources and all that. But that said, even despite all that, there are a lot of people who are working with each other and drawing upon their own resources and their own mentors to create a better industry. And that's what kind of gives me hope, is that everyone I talk to who has aspirations to be in the industry or is in the lower rungs of it, they understand they're going to have to work hard and they may have to work long hours. I don't really run across a lot of people who have this fabled, oh, millennials don't want to work attitude. Like, I honestly don't know where that comes from, because I don't encounter that a lot. I really do think, though, that the people rising up now, they don't necessarily think that I think they're less willing to do something even I did. So I only indict myself. What I thought of as creativity or passion or driven or dedicated or excitable or whatever the euphemisms were, I think I, even myself for a long time, without even thinking about it consciously, I think I may have given more of a pass or put certain behaviors in those categories that shouldn't have been in those categories, you know? And I think people rising up now are like, look, I will work hard. I want to get better at my craft, whatever craft that is. I understand that people have different temperaments and that I have to compromise and get along with different kinds of people. But abuse is abuse. Misconduct is misconduct. And, you know, I do think that we've raised the bar in terms of, I hope, the behavior that will be tolerated or won't be tolerated. That said, we just saw with The Flash, you know, I do think that Ezra Miller in the works that I've seen them in is talented. That's not a reason to allow someone to engage in whatever behaviors they want to engage in. You know, it's just,
well, and I think Warner Brothers did that movie.
Yeah, they did.
I think they paid a big price, because I think in the general population, Ezra Miller is poison, that they don't want to go and see an Ezra Miller movie.
And I think, you know, look, a big thing that I went into, and I'm really happy that I went into in my book, was there are degrees of dysfunction. There are degrees of harm. They're not all the same. And one reason to write a book was, you know, if someone makes a comment to me that doesn't sit right with me, and I go to them later and say, you know what, this didn't sit right with me, and here's why. And then they're like, oh, wow, I didn't realize. And then they alter their future behavior. Like, that's just how, like, sometimes that's how human relationships go. In this industry, though, what people are always afraid of is what might happen. Because people with power are not used to being questioned. They're not used to having anything they do or say be questioned. And so, you know, I had this long interview with Jeff Garlin that was published in Vanity Fair a year or two ago.
And he's a monster.
Those are your words.
I'm saying it. Yeah, those are my words. He's a monster.
Words. I mean, here's the thing. After reporting on Jeff Garlin now for 2+ years, his behavior on Curb, on the movie sets, and on the Goldbergs for sure, I have talked to dozens of people who have alleged negative and harmful behaviors, put it that way. But you also said some things which are interesting. But like, here's a perfect example of someone living in a bubble. When I spoke to him, at least he called me, you know, at least we talked. At least I was able to ask him things on the record, and he didn't hide behind 85 layers of PR people and lawyers. One thing that I just couldn't make him understand was, well, if people are going to complain about me to HR, HR should tell me their names. And I'm like,
why?
A set PA is going to do that? Yeah. Jeff, you're a millionaire. You're on 2 high profile shows. You make a lot of money from comedy tours. You have a movie career. You have specials. You are a big deal, connected, powerful, rich person. And this was something that more than one person alleged to me, that if people were complaining about him, he wanted to know their names. And I'm like, how do you not see that for exactly what it is? Which is, I mean, this is how it works in Hollywood all too often, is that I do think people do try to make their discontent known. And here's the thing, you know, Jeff Garland said to me, oh, the crew of the Goldbergs, were, you know, it's a tight-knit bunch and everybody gets along and they love me. The first part of that statement was true. It was a tight-knit bunch. And they did get along. Like I've now talked to many people who worked at the Goldbergs and across a whole range of capacities. But I think crews, my God, we barely scratched the surface of what crews have to put up with, in my book, certainly. And let me just tell you, if the allegation is that everyone in the Goldbergs crew thought Jeff Garland was just the greatest, that is not what my reporting revealed. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Why they bounced him off the show if he was such a prince.
And my thing with that is he departed the show after 9 seasons. Ken, do you think that problems with his behavior only cropped up in season 9?
Of course not. They just reached a point where they just said it's just not worth it.
And what, you know, I will hear, here's what I want to say here too, in that sort of spirit of like, let's talk about the positive. I've heard nothing but great things about Wendy McClendon Covey. And honestly, I've never heard it. People had plenty of opportunities. I've never heard anyone else in that cast. Not mm-hmm. heard of them.
Mm-hmm. Me neither.
And people uniformly, they went out of their way to talk about how much they love Wendy. And I'm like, you know what I feel bad about? Here's what I feel bad for everyone. But I feel bad about the fact that Jeff leaves. Wendy is now, you know, number one on the call sheet, but only for 1 season. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know exactly what the time frame was. I'm like, I'm really tired of people who treat their colleagues well having to put up with stuff like this for years. Come on.
Well, my partner and I have a speech that we give a star mm-hmm. if we are doing a pilot for them.
Okay.
And we basically say, we're thrilled to be in business with you. We will work tirelessly, nights and weekends, to turn out a show that we are all very proud of. If mm-hmm. you become a monster, we're in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Just won't tolerate it. We quit. We just absolutely won't tolerate it. That you start counting lines, you start being abusive to other actors, you start driving our director nuts. And mm-hmm. we left after a pilot. We had a pilot. And we had a star who the network insisted we take. Mm-hmm. And after a week, and after having talked to him about it and everything else, and it didn't get any better. And at the end of the week, we filmed the show because we didn't want to just pull the plug and cost all of the crew people their pay. So we dragged the dead horse across the finish line to shoot it. And then we called the studio and our lawyer and agent and everyone said, we're done. If you want to recast it, we're happy to do it. We are never walking on a set with this guy again. Done.
And I think that's like, you know, that's something that I think a lot of the people that I talk to in the industry, like, I honestly think in the last 10, 12 years, I think it's honestly even gotten harder to sustain an industry career because I think your daughter's in the industry, right?
Yes, she is. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we're looking at shorter seasons. A career was always precarious, could always be knocked off course by almost anything. But now you've got short seasons, smaller paychecks, having to hustle for more and more gigs. But you end up every year being paid less than the year before. And so I think on top of that, like, industry workers are like, no, I'm not going to put up with that kind of nonsense on top of it. And what's cool about the response to my book, I honestly think, Ken, it wouldn't have been received the same way even 5 years ago. I think even for me, I'd been covering the industry for so long by the time Me Too came around, but that kind of rocked me to my core. You know, so much of what I reported on, what I was reading other people, I was like, what the, like, I didn't, I've met this person, I didn't know, like, this is insane. So it was very, like, a whirlwind of pain and a whirlwind of revelations that came out. But I think what's interesting is that it's for people both inside the outside and outside the industry, definitely outside the industry, any intimation that this is a glamorous world was like, the public, I think, is much more of a sense that, like, it's a job. You know, a guy who is, you know, a camera operator or a makeup artist or, you know, a co-executive producer, they are people working at a job. They are not that different in a way from a gig. Hollywood's always been an industry of gig workers. And so, but now I think the public has much more of an understanding that it's not glamorous. Most people aren't rich. I think what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years has kind of done away with that haze of, oh, it's a glamorous. It's not. It's really not. And that's not to say that it isn't fun. The people that I respect the most in the industry work hard, you know, complain when there's stuff to complain about, which is often, but also really enjoy creating and collaborating and coming up with cool stuff to show the world. And that's always been true, but like, there's no reason, like my husband works in the financial industry and it's so conservative and so like, it's a Midwestern, It's a bank that has worldwide locations, but it's based in the Midwest. And I'm like, you have not met a more square group of people in the world. But it's so interesting, the culture of what will be tolerated in a Midwestern banking institution versus what's tolerated in Hollywood. Like, I'll tell Dave stuff, and he's like, before I finished saying that sentence, HR would be at my desk picking me up and bodily escorting me out the door. You know? He's like, well, how is this happening? I'm like, I know. This weird idea that people think, oh, because people are engaged in some kind of artistic endeavor, they must have some higher calling and they must be given some special leeway. And also, it must be a truly sustaining and fulfilling and kind, collaborative work atmosphere. I'm like, that ain't.
That's not the Hollywood I know. Nope. Of course, one of the problems is you still have so many people who want to get into the industry.
Of course.
So it's, you know, if there wasn't a writer's guild, then networks could pay $50 for a script.
And that's what
and
they
there
want.
Would be a line of people around the block who would be happy to take it.
Yeah, lately my thing is that Hollywood is both a cautionary tale and an inspiring example. Because in my industry, in the media, there were unions in some places, and those people were smarter. A lot of my industry wasn't unionized, and we got hammered. You know, places go out of business, get ransacked by, you know, these private equity goons. It's a nightmare. You know, the number of jobs in the media has gone downhill. And, you know, people are like, why isn't there more good reporting or good rule, good cultural criticism? I'm like, because nobody has a job. What are you talking about? Like, we tell the goons to stop destroying our publications just for sport. I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I lost the train of my thought there for a minute. But It's not different from, you know, someone who's a grip on an Amazon show is not that different from someone who is driving a truck for Amazon, frankly. And the fact is we're seeing these waves of unionization in all these different sectors but Hollywood got there because, you know, in the 20s and 30s, when the organizing began, they all realized there's a line of people out the door willing to be exploited for nothing. For nothing.
Yep.
If we don't form guilds, like I feel like what motivated the guild formation, if I had to summarize it in a very, you know, uncouth way, we're gonna get screwed, but we're gonna get so much more screwed if we don't set up a guild. You know, I mean, that really is what it comes down to. So I think, you know, if I may be I don't know if this is mawkish or something, but I really look at those writers on the picket lines, and I think they're fighting the good fight for a lot of us, because if AI takes any creative job, then we're all like, I don't know, like we're all living through some science fiction dystopia within 10 years, you know. I don't want it, because I think human beings write the funniest jokes, create the coolest and funniest and silliest TV shows and movies. So I look at the job action that's going on right now, and I'm like, they are holding the line for a lot of us who appreciate what the industry does do well. And if they don't hold that line, I don't know what happens, because, and thank God there is a guild to hold the line. That's
I agree. I know people say, boy, in this day and age, to go out on strike when there's all these streamers where everyone has opportunities to watch all of these shows. It's not like we're crippling the networks anymore. But the truth is, if we don't strike and we don't hold the line, then the industry collapses. Then there is no guild.
And then the funny thing is, you know, it really chilled me, even though I wrote this book and I've been covering the industry for 30 years. It really chilled me. I think it was Chris, is it Kaiser or Kaiser?
Kaiser.
Kaiser, he said something at a guild thing that I saw online, that he said, I think repeating something Mike Schur had said, well, if there's 500 shows, they want 500 writers, period. End of story. They want one person. And I did write about this. They want one person beginning to end to be burnt out. They might give them an assistant, but they really want to break the back of the guild and have it just be like a British model. You know, a lot of times in the UK, and I watch a lot of British shows, it's a 6-episode commitment. One person writes all the episodes. Maybe they farm out one or two or have one or two people helping them out. But I really loved that, you know, Jesse Armstrong created the most arguably lauded and successful show in recent memory, Succession. He actually came out to a sort of support action that British writers put together in the UK. So he went out to this London rally, and he said, he was interviewed for a few minutes, and he said, the reason Succession was good was because we had a room. We all bounced ideas off of each other. We talked. And it wasn't just Jesse Armstrong, you know, cranking out scripts, because at a certain point, you know this, you can't, if you write 10 scripts in a row by yourself, by episode 7, you've lost the plot. Literally, you've lost your mind.
Right. Then there's this moron, Taylor Sheridan, very good writer from, you know, Yellowstone and all. And he says, well, I'll get out of television if I have to hire a staff because I do all of my writing. Fuck you.
Yeah, honestly, fuck that guy.
Fuck you.
Because first of all, it's so insulting to everyone who does work on that show to present yourself as the sole auteur. I mean, it's so arrogant, so tin-eared. And on top of that, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but the Writers Guild supplies people's health care. It supplies, if it's not funded, people don't have, you know, they can't take their kid to the doctor. You know, don't be such, if you're that powerful, recognize you can use your power for good. And I don't understand. But the thing is, isn't he speaking CEO love talk? Like that's what they want to hear. They want to clone Taylor Sheridan and just have 10, you know, dudes like him crank everything out. And they're willing to throw money at those people, by the way. Like Taylor Sheridan's not hurting for money. But they want to have just one person cranking out scripts and none of these troublesome writing staffs.
You know, gets back to something, though, that you said, where you don't have mentors. If you don't have a staff, then how are you going to bring people along? So it's fine for now, but who are those writers in 5, 6, 10 years we're going to be creating shows if they have no experience? I mean, David and I were so lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we had Larry Gelbart and James L. Brooks and Marshall and Belson and Patchett and Tarsus. And, you know, we had these incredible mentors. that we learned from Gene Reynolds, like, oh my God, we were so fortunate. Well, without those people, you know, I'm terrible.
No, that's really what's inspiring about the writer's strike, and why I do have hope for the industry. Because one thing that people don't know about the Writers Guild is residuals have fallen off a cliff, as I write about in my book. Residuals were a way to tide people over when they were in a dry patch and weren't working as much. But the thing about creation of residuals, and you know this, but I feel like I need to beat the drum on this every chance I get. The residuals, as we know them, came about because the writers at the time who were pushing to fold residuals into the whole compensation structure, they said this will only apply to future productions. They gave up. They gave up what could have, they could have said, oh no, we want this to go back from this year zero of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They gave up what could have been their money. Like they could have just said, well, no, we want to get ours too. No, they said for future writers, we want this to be the way that it was. And that's what you see on the picket lines right now. A huge problem that I'm very, very upset about is everything that you just said. There has been more inclusion and diversity in the industry. There have been more people allowed to kind of like come in on the lower, you know, ground floor, the entry-level jobs. And they have been filtering up through the system. But as people keep pointing out, you now have people reaching the mid-level point of their career or even upper-level writer status without having spent any time on set, because they are not the mentorship and the training opportunities that you got when you were working on a 22-episode a season show. It's a whole different ball game. And I feel like people need to understand the writers are striking for, yes, better pay, better residuals, all the things. But one of the things they're fighting for, and I think it's critical, and every showrunner I've talked to in the last 4 or 5 years has been really, really concerned about this. They want those young people coming up, whoever they are, to be the next Quinta Brunson, to be the next Jesse Armstrong. They're not going to get those opportunities unless they know how to sit in an editing room and get that final cut ready. They know how to wrangle actors. They know how to take network notes. They know how to navigate. Like, there's now a few generations of people who, like, they know how to put the words on the page or maybe even take notes from their boss. But do they know all the other aspects of production?
And it's different skill sets. It really is.
Yep. Sets, you know? And now everything is so IP derived that if I'm the head of the studio, am I going to give that gigantic IP property to someone who's never set foot on the set of the shows that she's worked on? They're not. I mean, this is what's breaking the pipeline.
I remember David and I had a multi-camera pilot in 1979 at NBC that didn't go, got passed over for Pink Lady and Jeff.
I actually saw that show on air.
A couple of years later, we joined the Charles Brothers on the first season of Cheers. And we see...
Can you talk more about that show? I've never heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just 254 and out. Okay. Yeah. Well,
I'll have to look for it.
We saw Glenn and Les handle problems that we didn't even know were problems.
Right.
And I remember saying to David, had NBC picked up our show 3 years ago, we would not have done that great a job.
Yeah.
Because we were not ready. And spending time with the Charles Brothers and really learning how to do this, by the time we became showrunners, we were ready. But had NBC picked up that show, it wouldn't have been as bad as Pink Lady and Jeff, but it certainly would not have been as good as we would have wanted it to be, because we just didn't have the chops to get it over the finish line.
A lot of people who are climbing the ladder, which is honestly crumbling beneath them, are being set up to fail. And that really upsets me, because I feel so fortunate as a viewer and then as a critic and reporter to have come up in a world where, I mean, I actually love the 22 episode season because you can take a chance. You can show, spotlight this actor, play up that relationship on screen, can play around a lot more. And I do think it was an incredible training ground. And now, you know, I think, you know, Joe Adalian, and he works for Vulture. He wrote a big piece about how the streaming model is broken and the finances and how. And I sit there, Ken, and I go, the American television machine was a money printing machine that also trained a lot of really good people. Yes, there were issues with it. Yes, obviously there were problems with the old model. Like I can, my whole book is a pretty much about the point, what wasn't great about that model. So like, let's take that as a given. But at the same time, if you were a writer's assistant on a 22 episode show and you worked hard, you could get a job probably at that show or a different show, rise up the ranks and not just learn how to write, but see how other people, you know, a good writer's room is a cast of characters where, like, this person's great at character. That person is a joke machine. This person really understands structure. The showrunner is showing me how to wrangle this problem and how does the showrunner solve that problem. It's an example machine, you know, and it printed money. It was so, everyone around the world wanted that. They wanted what we had. And now it's being dismantled for parts. And I don't love it. You know, I don't love that.
No, me neither. But
I feel like the good things of the old model, if they get stripped away completely, that'll be a disaster.
Right. Well, on that happy note.
Yeah, I'm pressing people since forever.
The book is called Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and a Call for Change in Hollywood. Mo, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you so much, Ken. This has been awesome.
And there you go. That's my two-part interview with Maureen Ryan. Once again, the book is called Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and a Call for Change in Hollywood. It's a terrific book. I recommend it. Okay, our thanks as always to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, should you wish to connect with me, is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. And please follow me on Instagram. You know, when I post those cartoons, it really, you know, sort of helps my fragile ego to have people like them. So do that if you get a chance. But more importantly, come back next week for another episode of
Hollywood and Levine.